Michael!
Woo-hoo! Dave, what's up? Dude. Long time, my friend.
You know, I don't even know. I don't know what to say. For anybody listening, sorry. We're sorry it's so...
They're sorry. We hope people will forgive.
You know what? I am so impressed with other shows that can be on this you know, rock steady release schedule, especially when they don't make any money from it, because it takes a lot of commitment. And you know, you and I both work in healthcare, and as any citizen of the world should know, healthcare is probably more bonkers right now than it ever has been in our lifetimes. And so that is not the sole reason we have been so sporadic in our recording, but it certainly hasn't helped.
Yeah, well, you know, hashtag goals for any of those podcasters out there who are able to maintain that regular calendar of recording, but we'll get there. You know, I think we had a good thing going for a while, but life is wild. And I tell you all the time, it circles back to why we even have this podcast, which is because you got to take a step back and you got to add a little bit of not just Disney, but just whatever makes you happy. You know, you have to remember to step back and unplug, and that's what hopefully we're here for, to provide you with some feel good listening stuff.
Well, we're gonna try. You know, it's, yes, I'm happy, and I'll tell you what, you know, I between work and I work from home too, so it's even weirder to say like, oh, it's been so busy. But you know, just because you work from home doesn't mean that people don't expect things, or you don't have deadlines and projects, and it's been crazy work wise, which then impacts our ability to record. Sometimes you record at night, sometimes you record over lunch hours, and then, you know, there's just been I've had some family issues, nothing major, but an ill grandmother who's been in and out of the hospital. I had to take my cat to the vet on the spur of the moment at 9 p.m. the other night. It's just one thing after another. But you know what I have been relying on recently to wind down?
Just what's that?
Old things that I find on Disney Plus. And so, you know, I just come back to, like, when stuff is stressful, I pull up something like Fun and Fancy Free, or, you know, Oliver and Company, or something.
You said Bed Knobs and Broomsticks was one that you had
been watching that. And I just, you know, my other hobby is music, but you know, when that's a hobby and it's a creative thing, that can be stressful too. And I'm not complaining. I love playing music. I've been working on music on my own in my basement the last few months, and that is a way of recharging, but also sometimes gets very stressful when you're, you know, trying to make something a certain way. And it's nice to zone out and stare at a screen that is not there to teach you any lessons or make you feel bad about anything. It's just there to entertain you. And tends to be what I go back. I've been streaming a lot of park soundtracks while I've been working and things like that. It's just, when I get stressed out, it tends to be when I rely on this kind of stuff more, because I just need to be transported back to the stuff when you don't have anything else to worry about, which is what usually, you know, a good vacation is all about.
Yeah. Yeah. I was able to go on a good vacation recently to...
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Went on a cabin trip, like, with some old college friends, which is really nice. And I know I didn't expect this. We were going to Maryland, and I guess it's in this portion of Maryland where there's a lot of ski resorts, and our cabin was literally on a ski slope, because in the backyard there was the chairlift, and obviously not in use right now. So it was just really funny to be in that setting, but great way to unplug. And I know, speaking of vacations, you and I, we've talked about this on the podcast. Next year, that's our goal, to get to Disney and
Yeah.
But it's been bumped to probably next fall, but yep. I'm really excited about it. And it is important to do those things. So if, even if it's not Disney, just to get away, get away.
Yes. And, you know, I got really excited because my wife and I decided we were going to do a 2 or 3 day solo trip without the kids to Disney in like April, but looking like that's probably not going to happen. So
yeah.
It's looking like our full family thing will be in November. You know, some of the stuff I wanted to briefly go through at the beginning of this show is there's a lot happening at Disney World.
Yes.
Right now. Well, Disney in general, but Disney World in particular. And, you know, I got to say, COVID has been here now for a year and a half. Doesn't seem like it's going anywhere, although hopefully going to start trending better in the coming months. We will see. But, you know, it looks like, I mean, I am starting to feel a little more comfortable, especially outside, you know, with groups of people. I've been to a couple concerts outdoors, you know, wearing a mask often. But the prospect of going to Disney Park is still a little nerve-wracking, especially with little kids. But I think once my son can get vaccinated here, hopefully at the end of this fall, you know, I think I'll be in good shape mentally to be able to take the chance. You know, does the vaccine prevent you from catching it? No. But does it prevent you, hopefully, from catching the worst of it? Yes, it seems like it. So, yeah. You know, it's either that or we just never return to doing the stuff that you know, that we liked, that involved travel. And I don't want to do that. So, yeah. But, it, you know, watching, you know, this past week that we're recording this in the beginning of October, and the Disney World 50th anniversary celebrations have kicked off. And, you know, seeing a lot of people at those parks, hearing some of the reports from like bloggers and stuff that have gone there. I mean, it seems like they're doing it the right way. Not all guests are compliant with masks. Not all guests are compliant with social distancing. But I guess, you know, from what I've heard, some of the more skeptical voices that are online about safety measures have come away from those celebrations relatively feeling pretty good about how Disney has handled the COVID era currently with a lot of people. You know, anytime you get a lot of people together, you're going to have risk of spread. But, you know, I get at this point, I think as a society, we should have, like, accept that it's not going anywhere anytime soon. And so you just have to decide what your own personal level of risk is worth. And, you know, it looks like people are handling it pretty well out there, at least from what I've read. So a lot happening with the 50th anniversary. I don't know. I know you told me you've not seen the show that aired on ABC and is now on Hulu, and I think eventually moving to Disney Plus. But
no, I've not watched it yet, but I am very eager to.
It's good. Is it a glorified 90-minute commercial for Disney parks? Yes. But, you know.
But we love that. We love Disney parks.
Well, sure. And let's face it, you know, when Walt had his charming Wonderful World of Disney on, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. I mean, those were just commercials for Disney.
Same
so,
thing. Yeah.
You know, if you're going to engage with Disney at that level, you have to accept the fact that you're constantly being sold something. Right. So, but it's really good. There are some musical performances I could probably take or leave because it's not my taste, but there's some really good behind the scenes footage, a lot of great construction footage that I had never seen before. And I've watched a lot of these kinds of things. They actually for about maybe 5 to 7 minutes go into all of the sitcoms that took trips to Disney World.
That is awesome. That's so just like, so wait, how just, long did you know, they take to do it? Because, you know, we did that on our podcast and it took us months and months.
Yeah. Yeah. We covered every show. If you haven't listened to those, it's one of my favorite things we've done on the show so far. We watched every sitcom episode that took a trip to Disney World. Mm-hmm. So they touch on that, although they got something wrong, which is that in this show, they mentioned that Full House was the first sitcom to take a trip. Now, that is the first sitcom to take a trip to Disney World. But if you go back to our series, the first show that took a trip to a Disney park was
Blossom.
Yes, they went to Disneyland. So, but I'm pretty sure in the show they specifically said the first Disney park. They didn't specify Disney World. So I knew that was wrong.
Maybe they should have consulted with the Add More Mouse podcast.
You know what? For those of you listening who work at Imagineering or work in Walt Disney World Productions, you know, hit us up next time. We know this stuff. But they do talk to John Stamos about performing in front of Cinderella's castle. They talked to the cast of two of the members of Black-ish about their trip to Disney World. I mean, it was really funny because it's something that we've investigated, you know, I don't know. It was cool. But there's a lot of footage in there that is really interesting that I had not seen before. They actually do a really good job of kind of giving a very Reader's Digest version of the history of Epcot, which, you know, I think a lot of people don't. I mean, I don't know. It's hard for me to know because we obsess about this stuff. So I know a lot about Epcot. I don't know that the general public understands maybe what even Epcot stands for, or
I'm sure, you
know, how Walt envisioned it, how what they built was a very big compromise, but also a very interesting thing that it's never been attempted before or since. And then it's really about what Walt planned, what they kind of compromised on much later, and then how they're trying to keep it relevant for modern day audiences. And so I thought that was really interesting because although Epcot, I don't know if it's I love World Showcase, but definitely not my favorite overall park. But it's probably got my favorite history besides Disneyland. I mean, it's just such a fascinating, crazy development of a project. And so it's probably my favorite thing to read about is how Epcot came together. And I think, you know, the fact that they were willing to carve out time to explain all of that, you know, it's not like the history of Epcot's not going to help people buy tickets. It's just an interesting thing to know. It's something that no one else is going to have before. You know, there's never going to, well, I shouldn't say never. We may have some billionaire who decides to build his own city someday, but like, you know,
maybe on the moon, maybe, you know, maybe. Jeff Bezos will,
but it was good. And I think it's on Hulu right now. And I think it will eventually go to Disney Plus, but totally worth watching. I think it's 90 minutes with commercials. My one complaint is that watching it on Hulu, they show the same commercial every time. I don't have the non-commercial version of Hulu, and I'm pretty sure they bombard you with the same commercial over and over again to get you to pay money for the non-commercial version. I was so sick of watching this Beyonce and Jay-Z jewelry commercial. I think I saw it 15 times throughout the 90 minutes of the show. But really good. So you'll have to check that out and then let me know what you think. I think it was really good.
Yeah, I can't believe 50 years, though. I mean, that's what's really wild, too. You know, 50 years is a long time, but it also, you know, given what we are getting, time becomes different. And it's funny to think that it's really not that much older than we are. Like, it wasn't that many years.
How dare
you, sir? Time becomes different when you are getting older. I mean, you know what I mean by that?
Yes, I do.
Because you think it's like, you know, 10, 15 years older than we are. And then it's like, well, 10, 15 years ago isn't that long ago. So I don't know. Yeah. It's very big milestone, huge. But sometimes I always think of it as being around forever. And
Although there was a time when concerned it has been.
Yeah. Right. So,
a few other things I wanted to mention. Recently went to McDonald's because sometimes when my kids want ice cream and we're out and about, that's the fastest and easiest way to grab ice cream for them. And so pulled into the drive-thru with my wife and kids a couple weeks ago and ordered ice cream. And I saw that their current promotion, I had no idea, I don't know how this escaped my knowledge, but they were doing a Happy Meal toy promotion of to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World. There are 100 figures you can collect.
That's amazing.
I'm sorry, not 100. 50. Jeez, that doesn't make, 50. Duh, it's 50. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not going to cut that out either. I'm leaving that in. There are 50 figures you can get, and they're all standing on little podiums with their specific park behind them with a picture of
Love it.
And so we pull up to get ice cream, and I was like, oh my gosh, they got Disney toys. I was like, I'll take whatever Disney toys you have right now. And they said, you want all 50 of them? And I, my wife grabbed my leg and she's like, no.
No, that's when you say yes. Yeah, if you're gonna offer me those for what, for free?
No, with God, one, no, they're not free. They're like one. They're like $1.50 or something. Oh, a piece. So, like, you know, I would have had to pony up some serious cash for these things, for these pieces of plastic that are worthless. But
they will be worth something.
No, they won't. I did the same. You know, if you remember, anybody who's been listening to this show for a long time knows that, like, 2 years ago, I bought a bunch of Disneyland celebration cake toppers from Walt that were McDonald's toys, and those are essentially worthless at this point. So don't think the, but you know, they look really great. I currently have, all right, let me see, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I have 15 so far.
Oh, cool. Which ones do you have, or like what are some of the ones?
Oh, I have Rocket Raccoon. I have the boy from Coco whose name I can't remember.
Miguel.
Yes, Miguel. I have Olaf. I've got Jacques the Mouse from Cinderella. I've got Jiminy Cricket, your favorite. I've got Daisy.
I gotta
Pinocchio.
Go get these.
I've got Chip. I've got Pluto, Frozone, the guy from Soul, whose name I can't remember, Mike something, I think. I've got Nemo, Thumper, Simba, and Pumbaa.
Nice. Those are some solid characters. So do you have to get a Happy Meal, or can you
buy them? No, you can just buy them individually. But the tricky thing is, since there's so many, here's Davey's hot tip for collecting McDonald's toys.
Hot tip.
You pretty much, a lot of the dining rooms are still closed because of COVID. And so if you want to collect these, you have to suck it up and be willing to embarrass yourself, which, considering I'm a 40-year-old man of the Disney podcast, I think that ship has sailed. I'm perfectly willing to embarrass myself. But you kind of have to like go up to the drive-through and be like, hey, what Disney toys do you have? And then you have to deal with the person on the other end going, I got him.
Yep.
Still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. And
somebody had the gall to try and call me. And so, yeah, you pretty much have to like deal with somebody being frustrated that you're asking for something they don't want to deal with. But I don't know. It's super fun. My son gets a kick out of like, all right, let's hit up a random McDonald's and see what they got. And, you know, you might get one that you haven't had before or something like that. It's kind of fun.
Ooh, I'm going to do this. This is my next homework. Okay, so I'm going to – and now as you're talking, I really want – McDonald's French fries. That's like my favorite thing.
Yeah, they're the best.
McDonald's. I know. Everything else.
Jeez, man. Star Wars Hotel, Galactic Star Cruiser. I mean, we're not a Disney news podcast, but I just think some of the stuff.
Well, we did talk about that. We did talk about how the goodness. We've spoken about that already.
Yes.
It is. Yeah.
It opens March 1st. I think they're starting to take reservations here at some point in October. And, you know, when we last talked about it, I think I'm sure my attitude was that it was wildly expensive, and it is. Yes. I mean, it's expensive. Doing anything in Disney Park is expensive, which is probably the one thing that I don't like when we talk about this stuff, is that, you know, there's a lot of people that can't do this, and that's too bad. That's life.
I was just saying, it's remarkable that things can be that expensive, which it points to the fact that they have such a demand and such a fan base out there that they're able to put a price tag. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I know exactly what you're saying about the accessibility for others, but I think it also just speaks to the popularity, the massive popularity. And that goes with anything. I mean, if something
a lot of people only go once in their lives, you know, a lot of people do not consider a Disney World vacation something you're going to do all the time. I think most families, and I know, you know, it's like, oh, we'll do that once with our kids. You know, they're not like us. They're not psychopaths who are like, oh, I haven't seen the new nighttime show at blah, blah, blah. Got to see that. Although there are, you know, a legion of us out there. But, you know, my wife and I were kind of breaking it down the other night, and yes, it's expensive for a 2.5 day experience. You know, if you're going with like 3 or 4 people, it's going to cost $5,000 or something like that. But you know, we were talking, and if you're going to stay on Disney property for a trip, when you get the Star Cruiser package, you get access to Hollywood Studios. So you get park tickets that are included. You get all your meals included. There's no booze included, but you know, you get all your meals. I mean, it is all inclusive. And so if you were to break it down and say like, well, okay, let's go to Disney for 2.5 days, pay for a hotel on property, pay for all our meals. Yes, there are plenty of ways to make a 2.5 day vacation to Disney World as cheap as possible and as affordable as possible. But if you're going to like go all out and say, okay, stay on property at a nice hotel, budget for at least, you know, one or two decent meals a day and not just quick service stuff, you're going to pay a lot of money anyways. So, you know, I don't know. I when they first announced all the Galactic Star Cruiser stuff, I was like, cool, looks fun, not for me, probably never going to do it. And oh boy, the more I think about it, the more I could see, you know, my dad, huge Star Wars fan. And so I could totally see my dad and I knocking that out in the next 2 or 3 years sometime. Like, you know, I don't want to compete. I don't want to try and fight the demand for it, but I could make the case for pulling the trigger on it, I think, in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I told you this is like something that people just put on their bucket list, man, and like squirrel away and save up and make it work.
I think the price at first, I hadn't really thought about just how expensive each component of that trip is. And, you know, yes, you're paying paying for 2.5 days to be like indoors somewhere, you know, but if the experiences are cool enough and you get to do enough weird stuff that you don't do otherwise, then it could be worth it. You know, we'll have to wait for people's initial reactions and see. You know, I don't think there's been a whole lot of info about like, okay, you get to do Jedi training, you get to do you get to go on missions, you get your own story. It'll be really interesting to see how people react once they're able to actually experience it. And I'm sure Disney will tweak it over the next few years to make it more enticing. So I feel like it's going to be cool.
Oh, for sure. And well, Godspeed. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day
I will. Yeah.
Yes. And then before we finally tackle the subject of today's show, there's a lot of new stuff for the 50th anniversary. Harmonious, the new Epcot nighttime show, kicked off this week, as well as the new nighttime show at Magic Kingdom called Enchantment. And man, you know, I haven't watched either one. The people have filmed them. They're up on YouTube. Disney actually streamed Harmonious, I think, on an official YouTube stream. I haven't watched those. I tend to like to watch them in person. I don't really want to see them on video until after I've, you know, experienced them. Man, the reaction has been so bad, and I don't know if it's accurate, but I'll just say this. You know, it's totally fine to be critical of new stuff that Disney does, for sure. They're not immune to criticism. In fact, when you're paying for stuff, I think, you know, you're more than welcome to criticize things. But, yeah. You know, and I also don't love people. There's a lot of people out there who build themselves as bloggers and as influencers who are basically just, I hate to say it, they're just shills for this stuff, right? They show up, they got free things comped to them, so they're just going to tell you how great everything is, and they're not going to, you know, ever complain because they'll lose their access.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, man, I just think there's so many people out there that are just willing to hate anything new, and it's their way of showing how much they know about Imagineering or the Disney parks, or like, oh my gosh, this show has no continuity. The songs change too fast. And, you know, boy, they didn't spend enough money on this aspect. And I have no idea if any of that stuff's accurate, but, you know, dipping your toe into like the Disney Twitter world is just a horrific experience. I don't advise, I think it's good to have a healthy skepticism at some of their new projects, or if they open something and it's not very good and you don't like it, I think you should be honest about it, especially when you're paying money for it. But my goodness, I think there are legions of people that are geared up
negative
to everything that they do.
Yeah. Negative. It's easy to be negative.
Well, so it is, and it's easy, you know, and it's also easy to be positive about everything. I think you got to be honest about, you know, so and as a perfect example, okay? I've told this story before, but my last trip to Disney World, my dad and I went and watched Rivers of Light at Animal Kingdom, which has since been discontinued. And Rivers of Light had a pretty bad reputation for not being great. And, you know, I watched it for the first time on my last trip, and I thought there were parts of it that I thought were really nice, but overall was not super impressed. And I was kind of like, eh, didn't really do much for me. But my dad loved it. So, you know... Sometimes you can know too much about this stuff and maybe expect too much. And, you know, not every single thing you experience is going to make you dissolve into like a blubbering mess, because it, you know, it's some of this stuff is just what it is. It's a show. It's not going to be some sort of life affirming experience. You know, I loved Reflections of Earth. I loved Illuminations. And so I just got to wait to see the new thing in person. If it's not good, I will admit it then, but I'm not going to, you know, watch a TV version and then declare that Disney's lost its way, because
exactly,
people have been doing that for 50 years.
Yeah, that's a smart way to do it. Well, and I know we have to get into our topic today, but since you were talking about Star Wars, I just wanted to share something, although I'm not allowed to share a lot about this, so I'm just going to have a teaser here and a placeholder for when I can share more. But I had a encounter interactions with a very prominent Star Wars actor, and I know Dave, I was able to tell you a little bit more, but I signed an NDA, so I can't really disclose much yet until later in the future. But let's just say it was really awesome. I know it's the project I worked on was not a Disney project, but starred a very prominent Disney actor. So TBD. More to come on that.
You talked to this person?
There was like two words said. But there were hours spent alongside this person. So, yeah, I know this is like me saying nothing. This is like it's a total nothing. My wife's
gonna,
right now.
I know who it is, and my wife's going to want to schedule her own phone call with you to talk more about this person.
Yeah, yeah. And I know I'll be able to share more in the future, but let's just say it's a pretty cool experience. And I wish it was more closely related to Disney, but you know, it's definitely worth sharing on this podcast because it was a cool experience. But yeah, and let Kim know.
I just can't believe you actually got to meet Babu Frick. I'm surprised that Robin Frick has made it into another film that's non-Disney, but you know what? Good for him.
Yeah.
Or her. I don't know if Bobby Frick's a man or a woman, but you know, be interesting to see him stretch his acting chops in whatever film he's making right now.
There you go.
Okay. All right, man, well, let's get into this documentary. Yeah. So we're talking about the film, the documentary Waking Sleeping Beauty, directed and produced, narrated by Don Hahn, who is a Disney legend in his own right. I don't know if he's actually a Disney legend yet, but he will be. He was a guy who was heavily involved in a lot of the Disney Renaissance films and is still involved in a lot of the books they're putting out. And this is really a story about how close the Disney company came to all-out disaster and collapse in the mid-80s. How Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who is the third guy? Frank Wells. They're like the three-headed behemoth who they were hired to take over Disney, and they took it from the absolute brink of disaster, financial ruin, and
revived it.
Implement, you know, put in place the things that revitalized the parks and created the atmosphere for the Disney Renaissance to happen. And, you know, quite frankly, if that stuff hadn't happened, who knows? You know, you learn in the movie that animation was struggling. They were being beaten by other places putting out animated movies. This is the era when things like The Black Cauldron, which we talked about on a separate show, were coming out. And
I was just about to say that you know, for anyone wanting to listen back to one of our previous episodes, The Black Cauldron was one that we did about Disney box office bombs and or flops, whatever you want to say. And that was 1985, and that is precisely what set the stage. So everything we talked about, how much of a flop that film was, all the eggs that were put into that basket, is what leads to what this documentary is all about. Because as we know, you know, that almost took Disney Animation, you know, down to nothing. You know, for prior to the Disney Renaissance and prior to this disaster of the Black Cauldron, you know, Disney sort of had a monopoly on animation. They were the only game in town. And so this really is what this is just laying the groundwork. This documentary is all about. And this documentary, which you can watch on Disney Plus, came out in 2009. It's what I like about it is it uses all real footage from the time. So there is new narration and new voiceovers, of course, to drive the narrative. But everything you see on screen is from the time period 1984 to 1994, the period that was the Disney Renaissance and the period that this sort of all took place. And so that's kind of different for things. You know, a lot of documentaries, they'll have the new interviews that they will show you, but they specifically wanted to take you to that time period of when this was all going on. So, yeah, these new CEO, new president, new chairman were in place, and they were, like you said, kind of changing everything in order to make this work. I mean, it was a lot of risk, a lot of gamble, but this is what needed to happen.
Yeah, and there's really two things that there are two sides to this story. Well, I don't want to say two sides. There are two parts of this story, much like Epcot, right? You got Future World and you got World Showcase. Although yeah, that's changing, but there are two halves of this story. And if anybody hasn't read the book Disney War by James Stewart, it's a huge book. I mean, it's like 500 pages or something like that. But it is basically a minute by minute retelling of this documentary. Goes into a lot more detail about all of the. This documentary focuses just on Disney Company parks and animation. But in the background, a lot of things happening with ABC. ESPN, the parks opening internationally. And when you look at the end of Michael Eisner's tenure and when he starts making a lot of mistakes later on during his run at Disney, he's heavily involved in the parks. And that ends up costing them quite a bit of money when they open Euro Disney, which is now Disneyland Paris. Mm-hmm. So the two sides are basically these guys come in and they're new to animation, new to Disney, and they bring really interesting perspectives, really interesting techniques, and there's some pushback, but they push Disney into this new era where the things that they used to be good at, they reclaim, right? The animation, they revitalize their parks, they strengthen, because they almost suffered from a hostile takeover by a billionaire named Saul Steinberg, who tried to take advantage of Disney when they were most struggling. And if he had gotten his hands on it and bought up enough stock to have a large say in what happens, they could have sold off Disney for parts, they could have sold the parks to another company, or just sold off the animation division. I mean, that's why I say if that hostile takeover would have happened before Michael Eisner's brought in, we wouldn't know any of the movies we have today or any of the parks, and who knows. So it's the first side of the story are these three guys coming in and really changing the culture, changing everything, and getting rewards for it. And then the second half of this story is Frank Wells really sadly passes away in a helicopter accident. And for all intents and purposes, he was basically like, he seems very much like the Roy Disney, right? So when you look at the Disney company in the early days, it was Walt is the idea man and the public face. And his brother Roy is the brains, right? He makes sure that there's enough money to pay for things. He's the one who tries to make Walt's dreams a reality, or rein him in when he's going too crazy with certain ideas. And it seems like that's kind of like what Frank Wells was. Michael Eisner becomes the public face of Disney. Jeffrey Katzenberg is pretty much the public face of Disney animation. And Frank Wells seems to not be household name, but he is the guy who keeps those two working together well. Mm-hmm. And when he passes away, the two egos of Katzenberg and Eisner just spiral out of control. And you get a lot more detail into the kind of backstabbing and untruthfulness of Michael Eisner at the end of his tenure. And there are a lot of hurt feelings. No. Jeffrey Katzenberg wants a bigger role in the company. Michael Eisner doesn't want to give it to him. It turns into this in-house feud. There's all these petty grievances. And it basically ends up with Jeffrey Katzenberg picking up, leaving, going to DreamWorks to directly compete head-to-head against Disney with DreamWorks Animation. And Michael Eisner pretty much continues to make bad decisions that are not informed because he has kind of gotten high on his own supply, so to speak. He really thinks that he is Disney and can do whatever he wants. It leads to a huge problem with Pixar, where Pixar is on the verge of moving and aligning themselves with another studio. And it basically, Eisner runs himself out of the job. And so, yeah, it's like the first half is this very, it's kind of inspiring idea of people who are like given the keys to this kingdom, no pun intended, and are so excited to learn and, you know, bring their excitement to it, and they get their rewards for it. And then it's like they get to the top of the mountain, and in order to stay there, they kind of abandon all of their principles in order to cling on to power, which pretty much just ends up in the whole thing falling apart.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just like any business, you know, and we talk about that with the previous documentary we watched with the Sherman Brothers. You know, even though this is all family friendly, you know, feel good stuff that's being produced from the Disney company, it's like any business. It's like any behind the scenes that there's going to be ego, there's going to be drama, there's going to be a lot of tension in at times, and this is peeling back the curtain and showing. So it was quite an interesting story, just how controversial a figure that Jeffrey Katzenberger was, and like you said, just all of the things that were taken that took place during this time period. I will say, you mentioned Don Hahn as being, you know, sort of that's who directed this documentary, but also producing it was Peter Schneider, who was a former Disney executive, and so he was a prominent part of this film as well. And
and you know, it's interesting because I feel like after Michael Eisner was basically run out of Disney by the board of directors, he kind of was absent. You know, I'm sure there were hurt feelings. I'm sure he was embarrassed. But going back to the top of our show, in the ABC 50th anniversary special, he's prominently featured with new interviews. And so I think, I don't know how that relationship has been healed over the years, but he definitely was given his due. It ended badly with him and Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg, but they definitely brought him in to talk about, you know, where it was in the 80s, where he was able to take it. You know, they kind of ignore the end of his tenure, but they've definitely brought him back, you know, in-house, or at least, you know, they've tried to put a rosy face on, like, hey, there was this guy who, you know, regardless of his reputation or his kind of inability to keep good relationships with people long term, you know, we are where we are because of this guy and the people around him. And so that was an interesting, seeing him talk about his time at Disney in that special. Was, you know, if he was still bitter about it, he could have said like, nope, no thanks, don't want to be involved. But, you know, I think he knows he has a legacy there, and that's what he's going to go down, you know, regardless of what he did before or after. He's going to be known as the guy who righted the ship, and, you know, as well he should be.
Right the ship they did. I mean, I know we're talking about how this is the Renaissance, but I mean, it truly, it's cool to see the archive footage that they have in this, because you know, all of our favorites that we always talk about, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, and others, but those are the three big ones, and Little Mermaid. And so you see, you know, Robin Williams, and you see, I remember seeing Jeremy Irons in this archive footage. And I mean, I would get a little bit of chills watching some of this stuff. I mean, honestly, I know it's kind of, you know, I'm just being honest because
hey, you like what you like.
It's powerful, man. And just to see, like, you know, everything that pulled this together, because like you said, I mean, one wrong turn, this could have been, we could have never had any of this. And it was just remarkable to see what was put into this. And I don't remember all the specifics, but I know they said they came in and they said, listen, we're going to change this and we're going to invest in this and we're buying all new this for the animators and we're doing this and this. They had a whole list of just complete saying, we're going to, like, we're not going to be using this, you know, outdated technologies. We're going to, you know, we're going to put down the money to get this new animation equipment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These things that they did that, you know, it feels like before they were just kind of holding back a little bit, or just sort of, I don't know, they really flipped it around and made things happen. And I'm sure that was a huge risk, but it really paid off. So as we all know, but yeah. It's so crazy, like I said, about this archive footage, just to get that. You really did feel like you were in it and that this was made back then. Had it not been for all of the, you know, the narration that went over top of it, it felt like, you know, kind of like this was an old film we were watching, but it was really made in 2009.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. And there's, you know, what's interesting, and this is not featured in the film, but I remember this from just reading various books about Disney history. So when Eisner, Katzenberg, and Wells come on, you know, it's like, we're not doing business as usual. We're not going to do things like Black Cauldron and spend 5 years on movies anymore. We're not going to, you know, we need to make the animators feel better. It's like they came in, they did an assessment of everything that was wrong, and they immediately put in place new things to shake things up, you know, whether like they had the pitch meeting where like everybody who's anybody can come in and pitch us a story. Like, that's doesn't awesome. Matter who you are. You could be a janitor. You could be animators. Come in and pitch us a story, because we're just looking for ideas, and it doesn't matter where they come from.
Yeah. And you're right. You're right, Dave. They actually did mention in this too, that they said this is when they decided they would make one film every year, which is,
yeah,
it's kind of wild how that.
Going back to the idea that they lose steam. I distinctly remember that when Michael Eisner leaves, and they promote Bob Iger to taking over Disney Company. And then they also put the guy, the Pixar guy who is persona non grata now.
David Lasseter.
Yeah.
John Lasseter.
Yeah. John Lasseter. So they put John Lasseter in charge, because at the time, John Lasseter was like untouchable. Like, he was known as the Pixar genius, even though Pixar is full of geniuses. But he was like the head Pixar guy. And they put him in charge of Disney Animation because what Disney Animation had become was back to what it had been in the 80s almost. I don't know if the films were quite as struggling, but like, you know, Disney was putting out flop after flop. They were putting out things like Atlantis and well, yeah, I know. they're putting out these movies. Oh, Treasure Planet, you know,
which we've done an episode on.
Yes. And I'm not remarking on the quality of these films necessarily, because I actually think Atlantis is kind of cool, but they're putting out movies that are not connecting with the public and are losing a lot of money. Not only are they doing that, but they're also, this is the era where they're putting out constant sequels to their classics. So that's where you get, you know, Lion King 1.5 and like two, you get Aladdin Return of Jafar, you get Cinderella 2 and 3, you get Beauty and the Beast sequels that are all direct to VHS at the time.
The Magical Christmas, which we also did an episode on.
Enchanted Christmas. Right. And so I remember when John Lasseter takes over, one of the first things he said was like, we are going to stop cannibalizing our classics and we're going to move forward with new ideas, because, you know, I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to the idea that like, you're making Cinderella's 2 and 3, does that make the first one worse? No, but it might dim people's memories of how good the first one is, because you're just pumping out stuff that maybe has low quality control because you're just trying to sell VHS tapes to parents who have kids to entertain, right? So but I think it's funny because, like I said, you know, Eisner and Katzenberg come in and they're like, we're not doing this, we're not doing this, we're not doing this. And when John Lasseter comes on board and takes over, he's like, we're not doing this, we're not doing this, we're not doing sequels, we're not, you know. And now you look at Pixar and they've, you know, they've got 3 sequels to Toy Story and they've got 2 sequels to to Cars. They've got a Monsters, Inc. sequel and a series. Like, they've fallen prey to some of that as well, but that's just the business of animation and movie making in general. Yep. But I thought that was interesting. You know, the way the previous leadership at Disney ended is very similar to how Michael Eisner's tenure ended too. I don't know what that says about anything greater, but I just think it was worth noting.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I would suggest reading the book, the Disney War book, because it is all of this in this movie to like the 10th degree. You get tons of backstage drama and, you know, lots of people who had to be left out of this documentary because there's just, I mean, at this point, Disney owns ABC, they own ESPN, there's just a lot happening that contributes to first Eisner's success and then his eventual fall.
Yeah. And by the way, Bob Iger, you know, is no longer, like, that was the news, how his last, he was no longer the chairman as of recent times. So
yes, it's turned over again. So he comes on to replace Michael Eisner. And really, you know, Bob Iger is a much different leader than Michael Eisner. And I think they don't necessarily mention Bob Iger in this documentary, but they do show that Michael Eisner's understanding of Disney leadership was very much informed by how Walt Disney ran the company, at least as far as being a presence in creative stuff and also being in front of the camera. You know, when Michael Eisner takes over, he starts appearing on TV all the time on their ABC shows. he wanted to be the face of Disney, just like Walt was. And I don't think that's a bad thing. So I'm not criticizing it, but it's interesting that Bob Iger's leadership was very different. You know, I don't know if anybody could, like, until recently, Bob Iger, even though Bob Iger is a very handsome man, not like, I don't think he's ever been in necessarily a show or like, you know, he would announce park openings, you know, he would appear at like the D23 fan club expos, but he's not out there introducing animated films the way Michael Eisner was on VHS tapes, you know, a very different style of leadership. And I tend to think, I mean, who knows really, but I think Michael Eisner seems to be very involved in a lot of the decision-making at Disney, like very top down, you know, creative stuff had to go past him. And it seems a lot like Bob Iger's much more like, hey, we hire the people to run the stuff. I trust them. They got to make their own decisions. I'm here to make sure that things keep chugging along. You don't need to, you know, pass every single creative thing. Every hotel we're making does not have to go through my, I don't have to sign off on that. Whereas I mentioned Euro Disney before, and part of the reason why they lose so much money is because Michael Eisner became obsessed with hotels, and Euro Disney opens with way more hotels than they need, and just instantly like just shoving money away because they can't fill them. Anyway, different, whole other story.
Yeah,
but yeah, you're right. Iger takes over. Iger's in charge for a good 15 years, something like that, maybe, you know, close to 20, and then he hands it over to this guy Bob Chapek, who everybody online hates. Going back to what I mentioned about Disney Twitter, and I think it's too early to tell. I mean, most of the decisions about parks were made before Chapek took over. So Chapek has a reputation of being cheap for some reason. I'm not educated enough to know exactly why. But like the story on him online is like, oh, Chapek's just cutting corners. The quality's going down. But I think people just look for a reason to be pissed off about something. So,
oh, that's for sure. That's everyone.
You know, people used to complain about Iger too. People be like, oh, Iger, you know, all he does is go out and buy ideas. He went out and bought Marvel. He went out and bought Star Wars. He went out and bought 20th Century Fox. You know, he's not okay with creating their own intellectual property. He'll just go out and buy other people's to make money off it. I mean, that's a valid take, but also like having Marvel and Star Wars in the parks is awesome. So, you know, I don't know. I think it remains to be seen what Bob Chapek's tenure looks like. But
oh yeah, he makes so new. We'll see.
Maybe 25 years from now when we get the Bob Iger documentary, we'll be able to understand more what Bob Chapek has done under his
undoubtedly
leadership.
Undoubtedly we will. You know, before we go, another and I meant to mention this earlier when I was talking about the cameos and everything. there was like a glimpse of Tim Burton made an appearance.
Yeah.
Just in the archive footage, just because he was an animator. I always forget about that. He was an animator for a time there with Disney. And so it was cool to see him, you know, before, of course, he became into his own fame and fortune. So that was pretty cool. And, you know, I also, one thing I wanted to mention about this, because I truly love the way in which this was put together. A lot of this footage was, you know, personally shot on their own cameras and stuff. And you imagine just, you know, it's not like whipping out your phone as you do today. No. You know, those were clunky things back then. You couldn't even do it slowly. Yeah. And it was probably a distraction, because it actually, what I read was that this was often against company policy to have, like, you know, films and I'm videos, sure. You know, dirty behind the scenes, because, well, much like I said earlier about my own experience, which I couldn't talk much about, I'm sure that a lot of this was sensitive, private stuff they didn't want getting out there. Although, of course, back then, though, they didn't have, you know, social media where people can post things and things go viral and spread as easily. But so I just think it's remarkable that, and I'm just glad that the forethought went into this for people to film this background footage, this sort of personal home videos that then could be compiled for this. It's one thing people talking about it, it's another thing of seeing it yourself. And so definitely recommend this documentary. I'm really glad you recommended this for me there, Dave.
Well, I had never seen it either. I was familiar with the story, like I said, because I read that book, but seeing the footage was really cool.
I just love seeing people, you know, wearing those 80s clothes too, you know?
Yeah, 80s and 90s clothes, man. That was an interesting time at the Disney company for sure. Seeing Mickey and Donald in like windbreakers was, you know, very eye-opening. But, you know, this is kind of like, we've said before on our show, we have no access to Disney news. We don't go to the parks every 3 months to do trip reports. We're two dudes who like this stuff because it's a fun thing to fall into and research. And I love a good documentary, regardless of topic, but, you know, it's so interesting to see this stuff, especially when it's not sugar-coated, right? Because, you know, if this was a more probably company, I mean, I give them kudos for kind of getting into the ugly side of how these relationships frayed, because you could probably have just blown up the first half of it to feature length and been like, isn't this great how these guys came over and changed the company and, oh, what a great, you know, but that's not a story. You know, the story is the things that made them successful eventually made them, you know, get run out of the company, at least in Eisner's case. It was really interesting. It was really interesting. And
again, well, if it was too defamatory, they wouldn't have it available. On
well, sure. Right. They can't get too. That's if you read the book is definitely, I mean, I think it was sanctioned because the beginning of the book, the author has a behind the scenes tour. He gets to dress up as Goofy to experience what it's like to tour the parks. But it's a very not necessarily flattering picture of internal politics at any business, but definitely worth reading if you're into that stuff. So next up, I have chosen for us I've seen it. I'm going to watch it again. It's not the most exciting documentary, but I loved it when I watched it the first time. And this is a film called Walt and El Grupo. Also available on Disney Plus. And it is the thing that I need to watch right now because I'm stressed at work. It's really good. And we will get into it on the next episode, which will come sooner rather than later. I promise everybody.
But
this documentary is about the really interesting time in Disney animation when Walt is burnt out and struggling to put financing together for movies because of World War II. And they end up he goes on a Goodwill trip to South America, takes a team of animators and writers who are dubbed El Grupo. And it's really just a documentary about the time, like the month they spend on the road visiting all of these South American locations and coming up with the ideas that would later create Saludos, Amigos, and the Three Caballeros. So it's really interesting. It's a time capsule, and it's very focused on the creative, like golden age with like Mary Blair and some of the other really great animators and colorists and stuff. I loved it the first time I watched it. I'm excited to watch it again for this.
Nice. Well, me too. I've been enjoying these documentaries. So
I think we're going to do one more after that, possibly two. I might throw a little curveball in there, but I know there's another one after Walt and El Grupo we got to watch, and it's a bonkers one.
Oh, good. All of bonkers.
I won't spoil it yet, but it's wild.
Awesome. I think that, fact is stranger than fiction at most times. So, well, thanks everyone for sticking with us. I know that wait was longer than it should have been, but we are here. We are well. We hope you are all well. Tell a friend about this, and we'll be out with some new content soon.
We will.
Follow us on the Instagrams, which is @AdmoreMouse, and follow us, like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. Write us a podcast review. You can email us at admoremouse@gmail.com.
We will read it on the air.
We will. We haven't gotten any. We got a few emails on a regular basis, and it's slowed down. So send us stuff. Tell us what you want to. Tell us what you want us to talk about, and we will talk about it. Or if you're listening to this and you have a unique Disney experience, or you worked at the parks or something, we'll have you on the show. Just let me know.
Nice. All right.
I have possibly a new guest coming up who used to work at Epcot, so I'm working on that right now. I just met the person, and so I
enjoy when we have the guests too. That's always a treat. So
yeah,
let's do it.
Okay. All right, well, everybody, thank you, and here's hoping that our goofy little show helped add a little more mouse to your lunch hour or your drive home or to work or to school or whatever you're doing. And we'll be back soon.
All right. Sayonara.